Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get 5 Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
The old world is dying, the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. Today, I want to take up a figure, David Horowitz, who's both a tragic but also comical monster, and someone who's like actually a little bit hard to take seriously. I had an interaction with the late David Horowitz. It was about like more than 20 years ago. I was taking up some issues about plagiarism in his works, and we had a phone conversation. And he complained at length to me that his books were not being taken seriously. And this is a frequent complaint of his, that they were not taken seriously by mainstream publications like the New York Times. They were not taken seriously by the left, and they were not taken seriously even by fellow conservatives. Places like the Wall Street Journal and National Review and Commentary, which generally did not review his books. And I was too polite to say so, but you know, I mean, what I felt in my heart at the time was, well, of course, people are not taking you seriously. Like, if you just like look at the title of your books, such as Unholy Alliance, Radical Islam and the American Left, or Hating Whitey and Other Progressive Causes, you know, like you're obviously a right wing crank and of a polemical sort that flourishes on talk radio and other places. But there's absolutely no reason why anyone, let alone the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, to take you seriously. Now, to talk about David Horowitz, though, I have someone who has actually done us a service by taking him seriously, but who shares, I think, similar skepticism about Horowitz. This is David Kleon, fellow Nation writer, who's written about David Horowitz for The Nation, and like myself, has learned that as grotesque and absurd and petty and vile as he was, David Horowitz deserves to be taken seriously. So David, first of all, welcome to the show.
Always good to be here. So yeah, I mean, deserves is a strong word here. I think is worth taking seriously, maybe. David Horowitz, actually, before I go in, can I just read 2 or 3 more names of his books?
Sure.
Because I still marvel that this is the guy we're talking about. So here are the names of the last 4 books he wrote out of, I think, 60 he wrote over his career. Blitz, Trump Will Smash the Left and Win, published by Humanix Books in 2020. The Enemy Within, How a Totalitarian Movement is Destroying America, Regnery 2021. I Can't Breathe, How a Racial Hoax is Killing America, also Regnery, also 2021. And Final Battle, The Next Election Could Be the Last, Humanix, 2023. And then he died a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
So there we go. So this is who we're talking about. And I have not read any of those books, although I just yesterday encountered, I think, the last one at the Strand Bookstore in New York. And I opened it and it had, you know, giant text. I mean, it was clearly, you know, written for like someone with a sixth grade reading level. And just seemed like a complete conspiratorial rant. And yeah, I mean, why are we talking about this guy? Like, you know, we're both interested in right-wing figures. We both, you know, I'm working on a book about the neoconservatives. We talk about them a lot. Some of the people who fall under that label, at least, are, or at one time in their prime, were pretty serious intellectuals. And, you know, with our friends at the Know Your Enemy podcast, or John Gans, fellow Nation columnist, we're all fascinated by, like, the conservative intelligentsia and the different forms it takes. But Horowitz, he does kind of seem like he should be beneath us a little bit.
I will say, I mean, like, Horowitz in his books, like, would often compare himself with these earlier figures. He often, you know, very self-consciously cited Whitaker Chambers, right, Sidney Hook, figures like that. And, you know, like, whenever I saw that, I always felt like, you know, Mr. Horowitz, I knew, not literally, but like through their books, I knew Whitaker Chambers and I knew Sidney Hook. And you're no Whitaker Chambers, you're no Sidney Hooks. The Chambers and Hooks were people who had, like, you know, like, were seriously had been immersed in Marx and had lived through the slaughterhouse of the 20th century. And they came through their politics in a very hard won way. And more importantly, they didn't write books like Hating Whitey.
Right. But so here's where things get interesting. So I wrote this column, this latest one, when our mutual boss, Don Guttenplan, the editor-in-chief of The Nation, reached out to me and suggested that I write, you know, a little memorial on him. And I felt like I wasn't really qualified to do so. But as it happened, on my large shelf of neocon and neocon-related books, I do have Horowitz's memoir, which is called Radical Son, A Generational Odyssey, a more normal name for a book, I think, which came out in 1997, and I already had it. And I said, look, I actually am interested to write about the guy, but I think I better read the book first, since, you know, 400 some pages. So let me, in you know, actual normal book print, actually, like many books of this type, the editor for this who asked him to write it was Adam Bellow, son of Saul Bellow, who was also the editor or publisher of our mutual favorite book, The Controversialist, by Marty Peretz, among others. So I was like, I'm going to read Radical Son. I'm going to see what David Horowitz is really about, and then I'll write something up on him. So I took a few days and read Radical Son, and I was struck, actually, that, you know, as recently as 1997, so, you know, less than 30 years ago, David Horowitz, in my opinion, could write a compelling memoir, especially the first half of it. I think it gets worse after he has his right-wing conversion. I think he becomes a sloppier thinker, though there's still interesting stuff there. But it's certainly written, like, at a grown-up level with some literary aspirations and with a lot of interesting, if perhaps slanted, 20th century history and thought in it. And I do think as a book, it's worth taking seriously as a text, as one of the many conservative conversion narratives, like the, you know, Norman Podhoretz is making it as the kind of platonic ideal of this genre. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad I read it. It helped me understand the ways in which Horowitz is distinct from the neocons, as well as the ways in which his life kind of superficially parallels theirs. And it made me understand who he was as a human being. And I also felt, and I knew this going into the book, but that there are at least two reasons why Horowitz may have made it as just kind of like a reflection of what conservatism really has been in our lifetime. Probably more than two, but two that immediately come to mind. So one is, you know, as I wrote this book review earlier this year for The Nation about the one biography we have of Stephen Miller, who needs no introduction. But Stephen Miller, as I noted in that, was a Horowitz disciple. Stephen Miller, who's 1 year younger than me, he was at Duke when I was at Columbia. And to both of us, to many people in the early 2000s, if you were at an elite campus, Horowitz kind of haunted elite campuses. In 2006, when I was a senior and Miller was probably a junior, Horowitz came out with a book called The Professors. Let me get the exact name right. The Professors, the 101 Most Dangerous Academics in America, from Regnery. And that book sort of reflected what Horowitz was doing at this time, which was, you know, conservative demagoguery and polemics, but with a particular focus on elite campuses and kind of recruiting conservative students into like Republican networks, either as media figures like him or to work for Republican electeds. And Miller was his guy at Duke. And in fact, Miller, he had recruited as early as high school, because Miller, even in high school at Santa Monica High in California, was already this like young fascist contrarian mainstay on the Larry Elder show, which was the big conservative talk radio show in Southern California. And Horowitz, also a Californian, discovered him there and possibly helped steer him to Duke. At Duke, he established a branch of Horowitz's little nonprofit empire for baiting and owning the libs, basically. And Horowitz helped steer him to Washington, where he worked for Michelle Bachmann's office and then for Jeff Sessions' office and then, of course, for the Trump 2016 campaign.
Yeah, I just want to have a little bit of a digression on this one point, which is an interesting bit of sociology. Because if the Democrats are a gerontocracy where, like, you know, having very advanced stages of cancer is apparently no barrier to holding office.
Yeah, we should note we're recording this less than 24 hours after it was reported that Joe Biden has advanced, has aggressive prostate cancer.
Yeah, among many other figures.
Right.
On the right, there's a very interesting, and I think well worth possibly emulating, but maybe in a more modified way, program of trying to recruit the young. I would, you know, to be provocative, say that the American right has long been about grooming, and that the one sees us in like, and it often involves like not just like college students, but, you know, people who are basically like teenagers. I mean, the one example I could think of is Paul Wolfowitz, who went to like this program at Cornell where they had brought in high school students to live in a dorm room. And the master of the dorm room was Alan Bloom, who went to, you know, in the classic tradition of Socrates with the young, you know, corrupted the mind of this young.
This is a family-friendly show. You're very dangerous.
But not just, I mean, the Bloom, but, you know, like William F. Buckley used to do this like all the time of like, you know, going on college campuses, creating the young Americans for freedom. But also like even like among, you know, there'd be like teenagers who'd be writing to Buckley and he would be writing back. So this is a political movement that is very vested in grooming.
Yeah,
the young.
I mean, there's an element of this where I think they think that the elite campuses are like liberal or in their mind left-wing dominated. There are vibrant liberal and left-wing campus activist network that don't need the Democratic Party or like Democratic donor networks help setting up, really, though they may have them in some cases. But, you know, by contrast, they feel like they really have to cultivate people with the same pedigrees who are in the minority on these campuses. In any case, Horowitz, so as I recount in my eventual column, I was asked by a friend whose name was also David and is also Jewish at Columbia, because, you know, that's the world we're talking about here, where Horowitz also went. I was asked by a friend to review Horowitz's book about the professors in 2006 for the Columbia Political Review. It's not online anymore, but I dug up the text of it. And I basically told him, like, I'll, you know, this was so beneath me. I was like, I'll do this if I don't have to actually read the book. And if I can say in the review that I didn't actually read the book, and if I can write the review as a kind of like polemical rant, it wasn't very long, making fun of guys like Horowitz. And I basically made up a biography for Horowitz. I had some like dim sense that he had the neocon trajectory of, you know, going from left to right, and that he was a Jewish guy, New York born Jewish guy of a certain age. And so I just kind of made up a biography, and I admitted I was doing this, you know, that I was, the whole thing was kind of a bit. That I was doing as a snotty undergraduate. And I look back on this with some embarrassment 19 years later, but also I was right to a significant extent, or like ballpark right, in a lot of my assertions about what kind of guy he was, because he had turned his life into a kind of cliche, though in my mind, this cliche was mixed up with the stories of Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz and other people. You know, a certain type.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, it is a kind of guy.
And you know, now that I've like read everything those guys have written, and now that I've read Radical Sun, and I'm like invested in this in a way where I didn't take it seriously 20 years ago, I can see the very illuminating ways in which he's actually different from them.
Yeah, yeah, no. This would be a good occasion to like, let's rehearse the biography of him, because there are sort of significant facts about him that make him other than a run-of-the-mill neocon.
Right. So we can start generationally. Now, granted, there are multiple generations of neocons now, but often because they do, you know, prepare their own and they prepare their sons and they build these little networks out, transmit the tradition directly from generation to generation.
The grooming and nepotism program.
Exactly. And so with the neocons, there's a kind of a pipeline and a family saga. Horowitz is from outside that world. And until he had a completely autonomous transition to the right, he didn't really interact with them. He did meet them at some point, but they weren't his ways in. So, you know, if you contrast him with Irving Kristol, first of all, he's almost a generation younger. He's about 19 years younger. And that matters for the kind of Marxism he was coming out of, because as I say in the piece, you know, Irving Kristol was born in 1920 in Brooklyn. He had immigrant parents from Russia, and he was a teenage Trotskyist. He was a Trotskyist at City College, very famously, which means he was fighting the Stalinist kids who he regarded as dullards. And, you know, they were Communist Party members and they were simple minded, whereas the true independent thinkers were in this Trotskyist or adjacent minority in Alcove One. And that's, you know, a very famous, well-rehearsed story about Irving Kristol and his cohort at this point. And then after World War II, he kind of moves to become more of a liberal and what we now call a Cold War liberal, remaining very anti-Stalinist. That remains a through line. And then in the 60s, 70s, 80s, he and his cohort start to move right and to embrace Nixon and Reagan, and they become Republicans and neoconservatives, but they're still anti-Stalinist, right? And while you can quibble with any of their thinking anywhere along the way, there is this kind of like through line where the thing that really horrifies them is like Soviet totalitarianism. And how they position themselves from the 1930s versus the 1950s versus the 1970s, you know, is all based around, like, we can't have that, you know. And eventually, like, in the transition from the late 60s into the 70s, they look at the new left that's arising on campuses, people like Tom Hayden. They look at things like the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground, and they think, this is horrifying to me in the same way Stalinism, or for that matter, Nazism is.
Yeah, they conflate the two. That's part of Cold War liberalism.
All of these things scare us from the perspective of the sort of liberal civilization that we're wedded to, and that's why we're conservatives now. So that's you know, neocon 101. That's how they got there. That's what it meant, at least for a while, to be a neocon. With David Horowitz, it's fascinating how the first, like, almost half of his life, he's basically everything these guys hate. So his parents, so first of all, as I said, he's a generation younger, which means his parents were actually closer in age to Irving Kristol. And his father actually went to City College in the 20s before Irving Kristol. He wouldn't have been at that time, you probably wouldn't have called him a Stalinist, but he was a communist. And he was, you know, a member of the Communist Party, which his parents remained into the 50s. They were the kind of people that Irving Kristol and the City College people always saw as their antagonists and their enemies and as being above. And Horowitz was raised in that kind of home. He writes fascinatingly about the Sunnyside Gardens, Queens complex that he grew up in, where there were a lot of communists and they were trying to live in a kind of communal way. And actually, there's a digression. There's a fascinating bit in there that I hope I'm not butchering, but basically these were kind of like co-op style apartments and people shared like a common lawn area. At some point, I forget exactly what's happening, but basically there was an opportunity to be like bought out. And after resisting this with, like, you know, kind of tenant organizing for a little bit, his parents eventually did get bought out and then like bought another apartment in the complex. They had the lives of middle-class American capitalists by the mid-20th century, by the time he was growing up, even where it conflicted with their principles and their behavior as, you know, people who were, you know, carrying on with secret societies and who to trust and who not to trust, and were still very loyal to the party. So he sees this sort of, like, classic hypocrisy of the upwardly mobile American leftist, or at least he recalls seeing it in hindsight as he's growing up. But, you know, his parents suffered under McCarthyism. His dad was a public school teacher and he had to lose his job, and he eventually found another teaching job. But Horowitz kind of minimizes how painful this was in hindsight, but it was clearly quite painful. It's clear that he was growing up with a lot of secrets, lies, trauma, sneaking around. There are scenes of him being bullied by classmates for being a Red in the 50s and getting very upset about that. And his own little rebellion and transition against it is he doesn't exactly become a Trotskyist. Maybe he sort of does, but that's kind of an outdated term. He becomes a new leftist, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, his mentor in the 60s was Isaac Deutscher, yeah, who was
the Trotsky biographer.
Biographer of Trotsky. Not, I mean, it's a little bit complicated. Deutscher wasn't like officially a Trotskyist, but you know, like I think his biographies were very much read by people in that tradition.
Well, you can certainly say that tradition influenced him, and he was also influenced by I think some sense of Judaism by Michael Lerner, who ended up being the publisher of Moment magazine, but who was a kind of like, what, he was a rabbi and a new left radical activist in the 60s, and he wanted to bring in, like, you know, Martin Buber, like, Reconstructionist concepts, I think, into the left. He wanted to humanize. This is because Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956, 3 years after Stalin died, was like the breaking point for many American communists, including Horowitz's parents, where they realized, like, they wasted their lives basically in the service of a false ideology, and it was never quite the same after that. So Horowitz is going to college in the years after that and has to sort of figure out, how do I reconcile the communist values that my parents raised me with something more humanistic that wouldn't lead to the Stalinist purges? And he looks at it through the Trotskyist tradition, but he also looks at it through Judaism, and he looks at it through through the new left and its kind of new kind of radical activism that in many ways is about putting aside all the old ideological fights over Stalinism and focusing on what matters now in the 60s. And he becomes part of the heart of that movement.
Yeah, no, no, no. I think in all those developments of sort of post-Stalinism, but also the rediscovery of Judaism, which is a classic sort of 1960s second generation story. The classic line that sociologists do is what the father wants to forget, the son wants to remember. And so there was a reclaiming of Judaism among sort of boomer and silent generation American Jews. It's sort of rejection almost of assimilation, but also that the new left itself, and this is why, like, I always find the neoconservative framing of this like very maddening. The new left itself was a revolt against Stalinism. It was an attempt to do a kind of politics that was not based on the Leninist vanguardist secret society, but through a public performance. But in all these ways, he's very similar to a figure like Abbie Hoffman,
yeah, who we talked about,
or Jerry Rubin, or
basically every well-known figure in the New Left makes an appearance in this book, either directly or he has some comments on them. And he talks about Todd Gitlin, who was a New Left activist who eventually became kind of a liberal centrist and died in the last few years. Gitlin has a famous his sort of personalized history of the 60s called The 60s, which I read last year, which is a kind of like, you know, looking back on the new left with some chagrin. And Horowitz often references that book, which came out probably a decade before Radical Sun did, criticizing it basically as too soft on the left. He sees Gitlin and a lot of these guys, Paul Berman too, as being too soft on the left, which is funny because I often hear that from the other side, where they kind of, you know, sold out or betrayed the left or something. But from Horowitz's point of view, in hindsight, they're too soft. But, you know, Gitlin's memoir is a good companion read with Radical Sun, because he also talks about, for instance, how many red diaper babies, that is the children of American communists who suffered under McCarthyism, there were in the New Left, along with people who had no connection to that. And, you know, this is also a case where there's a real contrast with Crystal or with Podhoretz or Daniel Bell or any of them, because with those first generation neocons, because generally speaking, most of them came to leftism on their own or through their generational peers as teenagers. They mostly, their parents were, you know, immigrants fresh off the boat from Russia, from the Pale of Settlement, who were kind of petty bourgeois, poor, and, you know, it was the Depression, and sometimes still religious. And it was the sons, the founding generation of what would eventually become neoconservatism, who were, you know, kind of coming into left-wing activism and Trotskyist thought of their own. Whereas Horowitz is a second-generation leftist who got pretty deep into leftism of his own accord in, as you say, a rejection of the Stalinist era before he has his dramatic right turn. And it is a dramatic turn. It is, I mean, this is what gives his story some poignancy. Additionally, beyond, you know, I mean, it's crazy, first of all, that, you know, McCarthyism is affecting him as a kid or as a teenager at a time when Irving Kristol is writing articles somewhat justifying McCarthyism.
Irving Kristol's position on McCarthyism, I think, is comparable to what you see the kind of anti-Trumpism on the right, where people will not celebrate Trump, but they'll say the enemies of Trump are even worse.
Yeah, or I would even compare it, since Kristol was still liberal coded in, or even left liberal coded in the 50s, I might compare it to the stance of like a radical centrist, like a John Chade or a Matt Iglesias, who's like, in, you know, or Thomas Chatterton Williams, who's like furious about the campus left while still insisting they're very anti-Trump and anti his response. It was that kind of thing.
Yeah. No. But I think so. In the 60s, he is perfectly poised to, as a red diaper baby, as someone who's rediscovering Judaism that his family had kind of left behind.
Yeah, first at Columbia and then at Berkeley, where he lands, which are probably the two most perfect places to be a new leftist in the 60s.
Yeah. So he becomes, I mean, I think we should mention the exact nature of his leftism, which is, I think, seen in two things. One is he was an editor of Ramparts, which is a very influential magazine, and became a prime supporter of the Black Panther Party, a white supporter. And I mean, with Ramparts, I mean, if you actually look at David Horowitz's Twitter page, which is still up there, it still says under his bio, editor of Ramparts.
Yeah, he was a co-editor of Ramparts, and there's some passages that, having worked at my share of small lefty magazines, there was a passage that really felt extremely real. I mean, a lot of stuff in this book felt very real to me. You know, there's a passage just about Ramparts and how they tried to organize it as like a non-hierarchical editorial collective, and how this, of course, went disastrously, and they had to kind of like impose hierarchy because some people wouldn't take it seriously. I mean, these are eternal stories on the left, and you read them and you're like, look, David Horowitz may not be a totally reliable narrator, but like, some of this stuff clearly happened, and he's describing it very accurately or very believably, let's say.
That's very more than plausible. But so Ramparts, you know, in the late 60s became the kind of very hugely like successful magazine. Like, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies per month, partially because they did real muck-breaking exposés of the sort that the mainstream media would not touch, including most famously basically identifying a lot of student movement and journalists as being CIA. So there's a guy who later went on CNN, the liberal alternative to Pat Buchanan, named Tom Bradley, but he was outed by Ramparts as a CIA agent, as were many organizations. So it was a very important publication. I just think it's very funny that, like, you know, 40, 50 years after Ramparts ceased publication, Horowitz still wanted the world to know I was the editor of Ramparts.
Well, it was both something he was invested in for a while, and also I think it gave him some credibility that he really was on the left for such a long time. And he, so, you know, he was anti-Vietnam War. He was, you know, supported not just civil rights, but like the more radical and militant wings of Black activism. I mean, he was...
Yeah, the Black Power movement.
And he was also part of the counterculture in ways that, I mean, he did have a wife and four kids, and then he had his affairs, which come up more and more as the book goes. And he had some pretty wild second and third marriages in this book, and eventually settled down with the fourth one. But, you know, all around him, there's ambient drugs and sex. And I mean, it's Berkeley in the 60s and 70s. I mean, it's the neocons really, I mean, not that they never had affairs or anything, but they were not like this. They were horrified by all this. It's not just that they were anti-Stalinist. You know, what really pushed them from Cold War liberalism rightward was all the stuff we're talking about right now, was seeing campus activism, seeing dirty hippies, all the pot, all the homosexuality, they supported civil rights, but the Black radicalism scared them, the militancy scared them. And Horowitz was doing all that deep into the 70s. So like he embodied the kind of people, he was like a Tom Hayden. He was the kind of person, even if he would later call out Hayden's hypocrisies or whatever. He also wrote a book, which I just ordered in the mail. It's the one other book of his I'm interested to look at, called The Free World Colossus, a critique of American foreign policy in the Cold War in 1968, which apparently some people regarded as, like, he keeps saying once he's turned right in Radical Sun, he keeps referring, like, years after the fact, people will be like, The Free World Colossus was so good, like, reputable people on the new left will. Of course, that's him being smug and showing off, but it's also just like, you know, he wrote a biography of Deutscher too. I mean, it's just kind of like fascinating.
You know, he was like very seriously on the left. I mean, I will say something about Free World Colossus and the other books. I'm sure that there were people who praised it, but even at the time on the left, there was a lot of controversies about these books because they had been very heavily plagiarized. This is pretty much documented in a book by a conservative scholar, Tom Maddox, called New Left and the Cold War. But I mean, you can take passages from that book and the other books that he wrote in the 60s side by side with earlier writings by notably I.F. Stone and basically they're like the same. And there's this kind of like longstanding accusation made by the late journalist Bob Fitch that Horowitz's practice at Ramparts was to commission a lot of articles by different writers and then to spike them, kill them, but plagiarize bits of them and put them under his own name. You know, given the documented, I mean, this is something I interviewed Horowitz about. I think it's undeniable that those books, which, you know, maybe at a certain, the 1960s was a time of a revisionist history of the Cold War. There were a lot of people, notably William Appleman Williams and his sort of whole sort of school, Walter Lefebvre, who were doing like top-notch scholarly work. Horowitz was at best a popularizer of this tendency, maybe a successful popularizer, but he's also a popularizer who basically outright stole a lot of the words.
And you showed me a few passages that made pretty clear to me that the guy did some plagiarism. I doubt he plagiarized his autobiography, despite its superficial similarities to neocons.
Yeah, but. And I would say, knowing about the plagiarism, because he would then later do a lot of books in collaboration with his friend Peter Collier, who went through the same trajectory from the new left to the new right, I often thought that Collier's role was to make sure that there was no plagiarism, that he was like, that his, that they would, you know, could research these books together, Horowitz could make his contribution, and Collier's could clean it up and put it into prose so that, like, the source material was sufficiently reworked that it's an original work. That's sort of speculation on my part, but I think it has some, there's good reason to believe what I'm saying.
I believe you, and unfortunately Horowitz is not around to sue us for this, but
but I mean, he didn't sue. I mean, Maddox documented the plagiarism, as did like other people on the left as well, and he never like sued about it, so I don't actually think this is a contestable point. But having said that, these books were very politically influential. They were, you know, part of the tide of anti-war activism. But also, I think more importantly, we really have to emphasize, because it's pivotal to his biography, the work with the Black Panther Party.
Let's tell the story of how David Horowitz falls out with the left, because it is it's a wrenching story. I should say up front, I have not done, you know, deep reporting into the realities of this story beyond, you know, like, so to a certain extent, as I recount the story, I'm recounting the story David Horowitz tells, and maybe you have thoughts, maybe you don't, on how true it is.
I'll let you give the David Horowitz version, and then I will enter
right.
some
okay,
caveats.
Okay, yeah, I'm interested to hear the caveat. So David Horowitz was living in, I think, Berkeley and working in Oakland with Huey Newton, the of the Black Panthers, who he paints as a kind of a gangster hood figure with great charisma, who, you know, was essentially using the Black Panthers as a kind of front for his gang activities and, you know, robbing and killing and doing all kinds of sketchy things while, you know, gullible white new leftists covered for him. That's certainly how he's presented by Horowitz. So Horowitz was working with him and the Black Panther Party in earnest in the 70s, and he was helping Huey Newton set up a Black Panther school in Oakland for poor Black kids. And apparently the school needed a bookkeeper. So Horowitz gets his friend Betty Van Patter, who had been the bookkeeper for Ramparts and who was white, and has her come in and work in that role. Sometime later, in late 1974, Betty Van Patter disappears. And Horowitz asks, I'm forgetting her name, the woman she was reporting directly to. I don't have it written down, I'm sorry. But he asks that woman, who's, you know, an important player in the Black Panthers, you know, where she is. And that woman, in his telling, is, doesn't really care. Like, it's just sort of like, don't ask. Like, why is this important? Or what are you implying? And about a month later, Betty Van Patter's battered corpse turns up in the San Francisco Bay. And clearly before she was thrown in there, someone attacked her and beat her. And the murder is never solved. No one is ever arrested. And Horowitz is fairly sure what happened here is the Panthers had her killed, probably because she knew too much about their sketchy bookkeeping, since that was her job, and maybe she threatened to go public with it, or maybe they feared she would. So they had her killed. He alludes to many other incidents where he thinks they had people killed. And he feels deep, deep personal guilt. This is in, 1975 and after. At his role in connecting her to them. He goes through a sort of an existential depression. He beats himself up. And then what's additionally traumatizing for him, as he tells it, is that no one on the left cares. You know, he would expect this supposedly humanistic new left to speak out for this innocent woman who was killed, to criticize the Panthers, to demand answers, explanations. Nobody does. Nobody cares. Everyone just wants to, brush it under the rug. And in seeing that, this is, as he tells it, it's a kind of like, he starts to question essentially, the first principles of everyone he meets, to question what he's been doing with his entire life. He starts thinking about, how Marxism ended up in the Soviet Union and other countries where it was tried. He gets it into his head that, Marxism always inevitably goes that way. There's also this moment where he goes to one of the famous bookstores on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, and it's full of, all kinds of academic books. And he's thinking about his books and the tiny contribution he's made and all the books that he read to go into them and how it's all basically lies. And he just kind of deconstructs his leftism. His life is also falling apart during this time. He has the affair. He gets this fancy car at age 40. He crashes it. I mean, he's clearly having a messy time in his life, an epic midlife crisis. But, most midlife crises don't involve your, hooking a woman up with the Black Panthers and potentially getting her murdered. And it all kind of spirals from there. He doesn't actually come out as a right winger publicly until a decade later in the Reagan era. And we can talk about that in a sec with the Second Thoughts Conference and its legacy. But it is interesting that for about a decade after Betty Van Patter's death, he's still kind of nominally on the left, and he's still writing books with Peter Collier, though, the seams are starting to show. But let's hear the caveats. But I just want to say that no neocon figure I've read about has a story remotely that traumatic for why they went right. For them, the story, Daniel Bell's story is I was at Columbia, the kids revolted, I tried to negotiate with them, it didn't work, the cops beat them up, and I went home and cried. And he didn't even become he would deny that he even became a conservative. He never really left the Democrats. Irving Kristol's is basically I saw that happen and it made me sad too. Norman Podhoretz's is I saw that happen, it made me sad too, and also my friends all hated making it and made fun of me. And meanwhile, you have this guy who, to take it at face value anyway, got a woman killed, whose story is ultimately a journey from much further left, from Stalinism to the new left, to ultimately becoming a Trumper by the end of his life, which many living neocons have actually not
done. Yeah. Although I think Norman Potter, it's somehow. No, I mean, he's absolutely correct that he's much more immersed in the world of actual left. politics than any of these other figures had ever been.
With much more dramatic consequences.
With much more dramatic consequences. Yeah, I know. Now, okay, first of all, there's like, you know, a lot's been written about the Black Panther Party. And I think in this case, and I think it mirrors something about his accounts of his childhood, which is that he's kind of telling like half the story, right? Like there's like in the childhood, there's like, you know, that paranoid parents and this cloistered, you know, suffocating world. And but he minimizes, you know, how McCarthyism helped create that world, right? Like with the Black Panthers, I mean, like anyone, any like serious like study that's done by more historians, you know, in writing about the Black Panthers, talks about the FBI and COINTERPOL,
which he kind of writes off as a conspiracy theory, like that these guys were allowed to operate at all, prove that how much trouble could they really have been in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, there's a guy, Seth Rosenfeld, who's written a very good book called Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals. And in that book, one of the things he documents is that the very first person to sell a gun to a member of the Black Panther Party was an FBI asset. Was an informer to the FBI, right? And so, like, if one looks at, like, what, you know, COINTERPOL was doing and what these other institutions were, you know, like the FBI, but, you know, like, also the DEA, like, all the kind of resources that the both the Johnson and Nixon administration put to crush Black radicalism, then you get a very different picture. And I think the fact that he doesn't, like, address that and the way that that contributed to this atmosphere of paranoia really gets at something. And the other account is like saying, well, you know, like who, nobody else was questioning the Black Panthers. Well, I have to tell you, there was a very famous essay by Tom Wolfe that, you know, ran in New York Magazine called Radical Chic and Mama-ing the Black Culture. Now, Wolfe is a, you know, conservative leaning guy, but New York Magazine, very mainstream publication. He was all about mocking the Black Panthers.
Well, to be fair, I don't think he thinks no one.
No. And the New Yorker Magazine in the early 70s wrote this piece by Edward J. Epstein, you know, another kind of, you know, centrist conservative figure, blaming the Black Panther Party for a lot of the kind of police killings that had happened. Now I just didn't know both of those cases of, like, he's saying that there was no questioning of the Black Panthers on the left. And, you know, I would certainly say, like, among on the sort of mainstream liberal side, there's a huge hostility and questioning of the Black Panthers. And on the left, there were also people, there was, like, a lot of controversy about the Black Panthers. So his kind of account of, like, I'm the one truth teller, you know, when he's actually coming to conclusions that were much more widely shared, you know, just rings false. And the final thing that makes me very skeptical of his story is the timing lag that you mentioned, which is, you know, like this all happens in 74, 75. He continues to write books with Peter Collier, which are more like sort of biographies of, you know, the Ford family, the Kennedys, and which are read and reviewed as, you know, like coming from this, you know, former New Left guy who's very critical of American capitalism and sort of, you know, these wealthy families. And so, and his conversion to the right doesn't happen until the late 80s, you know, like with the sort of like, so again,
I have a passage that will fascinate you on this exact thing that I just found in my copy. So this is in the 80s. This is around the time he does his Second Thoughts conference, which was attended by, among others, he lists some great names, Alexander Coburn and Christopher Hitchens of The Nation, Eric Alterman of Mother Jones, Todd Gitlin of Tikkun, and Sidney Blumenthal of The Washington Post, all of whom he characterizes as leftist reporters at the time, which is interesting in light of many of their subsequent trajectories.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a constant conflation in his work between liberals and the left, which again, kind of maddening, but go on.
Oh, yeah. And he talks about the distinguished panel that was brought in, which included Hilton Kramer and P.J. O'Rourke hosted it, and there was intellectual leaders of the previous Second Thoughts generation, Irving Kristol, William Phillips, Norman Podhoretz, and Nathan Glazer. He says, Marty Peretz, who had been a funder of Ramparts and now edited the New Republic, was the moderator. While Peretz qualified as a second thoughter under our rules, he still regarded himself as a man of the left and was generally regarded that way by others. I'm not sure how true the last part of that was by the mid-80s.
No. Peretz was not regarded as a man of the left in the late 1980s. I was there.
Well, so then flashing forward two pages, Horowitz writes, "We should have found first he says, although we were best-selling authors, there were no longer friendly pages for our writings in influential liberal journals like the New York Times, the Atlantic, Harper's, the New Yorker, the New York Review of Books, and the Washington Post. Those were reserved for our literary executioners, Gitlin, Hitchens, Blumenthal, and their friends." And then he writes, and this is the punchline here, "We should have found a home in Marty Peretz's New Republic, which took a strong anti-communist stand under his leadership and supported the Contras. But the magazine had a dual personality because of Marty's decision to give key positions to men of the left who declared war on us when we published a manifesto of our second thoughts." Blah, blah, blah. But the point is, you know, all of these guys that we think of as, you know, essentially members of the left who were moving right in the 80s and in some ways converging with a lot of neocon thought, or would by, let's say, the Iraq War era converge by some critical neocon thought on some critical topics. And some of these guys are still around. All of them were too left-wing for Horowitz. He basically had to vault over them to the far right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that second thoughts moment where he did try to win an entry point with the kind of neoconservative movement, the classic neoconservative movement, by inviting Hilton Kramer and Marty Peretz and others, that is actually a part of his political evolution, because what he found, and I think one can go back and look at the transcripts, because I remember reading about the conference at the time, was a lot of these older generation had nothing but scorn for Horowitz for a variety of reasons. What is the kind of, you know, that Irving Kristol snobbishness? Well, you know, like, if you're smart, you're a Trotskyist. You were never a Stalinist, right?
Right. He had started out beneath them, and he, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's like, you know, like kind of like an ethnic element of this, of that, you know, like Irving Kristol and the others were, and Hilton Kramer certainly belonged to the generation of super assimilationists who followed the Lionel Trilling model of trying to become more British than the British, you know, wearing the nice suits. Whereas, like, Horowitz was still the kind of, you know, unassimilated Jew who will, like, you know, like is it was going to be blunt and rude and, you know, do all the stereotypical things.
I mean, to be fair,
things.
I think all of that pretty well describes Norman Pat Horowitz, too, despite his mentoring from Trilling.
Yeah, I mean, the grooming by Lionel Trilling did not take in that case. So I think that, and this is something that's like, you know, there's a great article about Horowitz in Tablet, which he quotes him on this point, where he's like, you know, he's very bitter that, like, the mainstream conservatives, the National Review, Commentary, Wall Street Journal conservatives didn't take him seriously. And so if you're shut out from the left, you know, you burned your bridges there. The sort of, even the neoconservative right, the respectable right, you know, kind of is a bit wary of you, and becomes even more wary when he, you know, does all these inflammatory, you know, 101 professors, you know, books. Then the only place left, but it's a very nice niche, is the kind of, you know, longstanding network of the radical right, of things like the Bradley Foundation, which gave, like, you know, I don't know how much is the total sum, but in the last, like, decade, gave like around $8 million. To the David Horowitz Foundation, David Horowitz's thing. It is that kind of, like, old McCarthyite right of, like, these Midwestern billionaires who basically think liberalism is communism anyways. So Horowitz was left with a position where, like, that was the one niche he was left to operate on. Not to say this all cynical, like, that's also where he was most comfortable with, because it replicated his worldview. I think that the interesting thing is, psychologically, the red diaper baby that, you know, tries to recreate McCarthyism, tries to become, it's the child who's bullied who becomes a bully syndrome. The fact that the left part of his identity was always something he was grappling with and always wanted to be known as, I was the editor of Ramparts, right? Like he would never say, like, I'm the editor of whatever it's called, Free Thought or whatever, like, Heterodoxy, you know, he did these other publications. Like, nobody cares about those publications. His big achievement was Ramparts. And so I think that's all very interesting. But there's one last thing that we haven't mentioned. One last thing, which is the Silicon Valley.
This is crucial to get in here. So if one part of David Horowitz's legacy is Stephen Miller and that strain of the right and, you know, other kind of, you know, young fascists that he groomed, as you say, at campuses. The other fascinating half, and I only learned this, I don't know, maybe a month before I was assigned to write this, and everyone I tell or everyone who reads the review and learns this for the first time, their mind is blown. Horowitz had four kids, and who he, you know, discusses briefly here and there in the book. And his third kid was his son, Benjamin. And Ben Horowitz, who, you know, gets a few lines in the book, is now the business partner of Marc Andreessen. They formed a venture capital company in 2009 called Andreessen Horowitz, usually called A16Z. And they have funded all kinds of stuff in Silicon Valley. They're billionaires. And although they funded Democrats before, and actually Horowitz did give some money to Harris in this cycle, they also gave millions of dollars to Donald Trump in his 2024 campaign. And Andreessen Horowitz have a podcast together, a YouTube show together, where they were both very, very happy that Trump won. Now, this has a lot to do with the Silicon Valley story it tells itself about the last few years, where Democrats always used to be the pro-tech, pro-Silicon Valley party, but under Joe Biden, they got into regulation and anti-monopoly stuff. And, you know, Lina Khan and the Silicon Valley people felt they'd never been treated worse, so they had to support Donald Trump. And that's how you end up with, like, Elon Musk and Doge and all this stuff. And so you could argue, and I sort of imply this in my piece, that the Trump coalition is in part, you know, between these kind of xenophobic nativist, you know, far-right Latter-day Bircher guys like Stephen Miller and these Silicon Valley oligarchs like Musk and Andreessen and Peter Thiel and Ben Horowitz, son of David. But you can also look at it as a kind of a sociological, you know, as an American story where in one generation you have like Stalinist Communist Party members in Queens, their son becomes a new leftist in Berkeley and then moves right. And his son, of course, becomes a billionaire in Silicon Valley. You know, one of these only in America, and also I think very Jewish stories.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I actually had to run in with Ben Horowitz online because I did actually know that Ben Horowitz was the son of David Horowitz. And this is like about 8 to 10 years ago. And Horowitz was at that time a big donor to the Democratic Party, but also gave money to some of his father's enterprises. And I was like, you know, kind of like quizzing Ben Horowitz. Well, you know, like, you're a Democrat, but you're giving money to this, like, you know, like, organization that's saying, like, you know, Black Lives Matter is a Stalinist cult or whatever. You know, and then we had a back and forth, ending with Ben Horowitz blocking me.
These guys love open debate. They always.
Yeah. But particularly at that point, Ben Horowitz was saying, well, you know, like, I believe in free debate. Before he blocked me, and that's why I'm so, you know, that's something I disagree with my father on other issues, but, you know, but I think that at that point, and this is a decade ago, like, I think the seeds of the Silicon Valley turn to the right were already, you know, well in evidence, and so none of this surprises me.
It is in some ways, I think, the perfect coda for the life of this man who's a tragic, pathetic, and kind of loathsome figure, but at the same time, I think he does have a kind of a notable American life, I think, and I'm very glad.
Very big American life, very important American life. Unfortunately, important. And I will link to your essay about it because I highly recommend it to everyone.
Thanks, Jude.
Once again, it's my guest here was David Kleon. It was a great pleasure to talk to him.
Always.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get 5 Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.